this meter is just going up and up and up and up and up and up and up.
Yeah.
And these episodes are so expensive. How does this fit into the Mr. Beast business?
How much time we got?
You're becoming like Coca-Cola or like Procter & Gamble.
What have you learned about scaling companies?
It's hard. That was a rough decision. It's been such a large part of my life and I've never even spoke about it publicly.
How are you doing that?
It's not all creators' faults. It's also like the companies that are working with creators. Anything past that, you're just going to destroy your YouTube channel or it's just going to fail.
Is Netflix calling creators now? Is Prime Video calling more creators?
In what world would you recommend that we do it?
That I have a lot to say. Yeah.
Today on the Colin and Samir Show, we're joined again by Mr. Beast.
For the fifth time, I believe, in the history of our show.
We've had Jimmy on a lot. We've had a lot of long form conversations with Jimmy. And obviously, like 2024 was a roller coaster of a year. For Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mix of, you know, being thrust into the mainstream public eye through controversies, as well as thrust into the mainstream public eye because of the most expensive unscripted reality show of all time with Amazon Prime and Beast Games.
I would say even outside of being thrust into the mainstream through the controversy, he also became the center of the YouTube commentary world. Like the sheer number of videos that came out about Jimmy this year.
Yeah.
For any number of reasons was unlike any other year since we've been friends with him and since we've been making episodes with him.
Now, I mean, we're friends with Jimmy. We've been friends for years. We talk quite a bit. And having him on the show in like a long form setting throughout the year, I mean, that was something that we talked about quite a bit. You know, the way it shook out, Jimmy ended up going on Oompa's podcast to talk about everything, talk about all the controversy and everything that had gone on. And then we went out to Toronto and spent, you know, a week with him in the middle of filming Beast Games, or right at the beginning of that, and released a long form behind the scenes documentary with him. So it has been a complicated year for even us to be friends with Jimmy and solve, like, navigate how to talk about it on the channel, how to talk about how to sit down with him.
I mean, there's no doubt that we saw comments from all of you and from our audience being like, wait, when are you going to talk about Mr. Beast? When are you going to have Jimmy on the show? And a lot of it was pretty strange because it's like, we're talking with Jimmy, we're friends with him.
Yeah.
He had yet to speak for a while. And he said that was one of his biggest regrets, was that he did not sort of talk about it soon enough. And so it felt really strange to like be speaking with him and know more than like the public knew.
Sure.
And to then think, okay, we're going to go make a video and potentially hold back anything because we've already spoken with him. Like it was sort of a weird middle ground, and it just left us in a place of, okay, you know what? We're going to let him speak about his stuff and everything that's going on before we speak about it.
And I also don't fault anyone in the audience who feels like, or who felt like we weren't talking about it. We weren't.
Totally. We cover YouTube, we cover the creator economy, and we've talked a lot about Mr. Beast.
Yeah.
So I can totally empathize with that.
I get it. And the only thing I would say is like, I truly didn't know. I didn't know how to approach it. And I think like Jimmy going on and speaking for himself, I'm glad he did that. I'm glad we went behind the scenes and like saw Beast Games with our own eyes and got to cover it through behind the scenes. And when it comes to this conversation, you know, this is a very different conversation. This is a conversation that's very future facing. This is about us honestly being very curious with him as much as we talk. The one thing that we didn't talk about that much this year is like, where are you going? Where are you going with all of this? What happens next? How does Beast Games fit into everything you're doing? What are you doing with Chocolate? What is happening with the Mr. Beast business? I mean, honestly, like, you know, we talk as friends, we talk about a lot of personal stuff, but then, you know, the business side, we really haven't had an opportunity to talk to him about it. And so we took that opportunity when he came by LA for the premiere of Beast Games and sat down with him and wanted to talk about where the Mr. Beast business is going.
I told you this, but like, as I was listening back, it was one of my favorite episodes that we ever did. And I think it's because, one, I think he was more relaxed maybe than he's ever been. And maybe it has to do with being in this space for the first time. But two, we really get into advice for the more advanced creator. You know, like the first time we sat down with Jimmy, it was very much like titles, thumbnails, retention. And this is much more for the advanced creator or the creator who's just building a business for the entrepreneur, because that is such a passion of his.
And we do spend a lot of time talking about Beast Games, the show. I mean, we were there in the beginning. We've watched now. We're right in the middle of the season, talking to him about his perspective on how the world of Hollywood should engage with the world of creators. And that's been a major subject we've been talking about. It's very interesting to hear his vantage point and his advice to creators as we potentially move into this world where streamers are going to be engaging creators. Mm-hmm. I think I'll say in our continued coverage of Jimmy, one of the interesting things is to watch the maturation of the creator economy through his experiences. Now, there's only one of him. He gets the opportunities. He goes through the things that he goes through that it's very singular for him. But it does represent where we are as an industry. And across these five interviews, it has been really interesting to see where we've come, how he's gone from like 19 people at a company to 400, how he's gone from, you know, YouTube videos to now working with reality TV producers and making a show. Like, it is a really interesting marker of time every time we get to sit down with him.
And as he goes from maybe selling merch to having massive CPG brands that sell all over the world.
Yeah.
So I think you will all really enjoy this episode.
All right. Now, for the fifth time on the Colin and Samir show, here's our conversation with Mr. Beast. All right, dude, Jimmy. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's the first time we're doing this here.
I know.
In LA.
I feel like you're like CGI'd.
And we were talking before we turned the cameras on how weird it is to be in their place.
I know.
I mean,
it's crazy.
LA, home turf for you guys.
How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. I assume this is going to go out after Beast Games drops. Yeah. But right now, Beast Games comes out in 2 days. I'm struggling to sleep at night. I'm so excited and filled with so much energy. Like, I dream of it. I think of it. I live it. It's really messing with me. Like, I need Beast Games to drop so I can like get a good night's sleep.
That's like exactly what you said almost last time we sat down with you. You were like, I'm just not sleeping at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Maybe this is just a reoccurring problem.
That's like a year ago.
Last time we sat down, we talked about Beast Games. Obviously, it was just a concept at that time, and it had sold, but you hadn't made it yet. One of the things you said, if this flops and nobody likes it, then everyone will just think I'm a YouTuber.
Yep.
And I'm curious to talk about, now that you've filmed it, how confident are you in the inverse of that, in the success of it?
Yes, very confident. I think sorry, I don't mean to kick your table. I think it's going to do really well. You guys have seen an episode or two. I sent the show early to Casey Neistat, and because he's like super critical. Occasionally I'll send him like a Beast Philanthropy video because he likes helping with those. And he just rips into them every single time and tells me how to make it better. And it's great. But this show is different. Like, I've been working on this for a year and I was really nervous to send it to Casey because I was like, if he just destroys this, I'm going to lose all confidence. And so he sat down with his like kids watched it. And he told me that after he watched episode one, that like his kids were like, why did he do that? Why did that person take that money? Why did he screw her over? Mm. And he's like, and even the next morning they were talking about what they would have done. And then he's like, I think this is going to like do really well just based on like, you know, the people I'm showing it to. They're all they talk about is what they would have done. And it's like, you never really have that kind of moment. So it's interesting. I've gotten that feedback quite a bit. And I don't think I realized that when filming the show, that would be the thing people would kind of latch on to and really like. Because I was, you know, I'm focused on getting you to like the contestants and this and that. And I wasn't even thinking like, oh, the normal viewer is just going to be like, what would I do in that situation? Would I screw my friend over for $100,000? Would I do blank? But yeah, I mean, a lot of people will probably expect, oh, Jimmy just threw a bunch of money at sets and gave away a bunch of money. But I think they're not going to expect is that we also like, I think this is one of the best like contestant competition show stories like that has ever been put out there. And I think all that together, it's just a blend of things you can't find anywhere else. So I think people are I think it's going to do really well.
The thing I've been thinking about a lot is streaming platform versus YouTube, right? Because when I watch some of these, I'm like, in the future, does Beast Games just exist on YouTube, right? And
in your original like thing that you said where we started this interview is like, oh, if this flops, people will think I'm just a YouTuber.
Yeah.
I said to Samir earlier, we were talking about that line. I was like, is that such a bad thing?
Well, because like the big difference.
But YouTube is like on top of streaming platforms.
I'm cool with being just a YouTuber. I guess I probably should have elaborated more when I said that. It's just a YouTuber that knows how to manipulate an algorithm. Because I think that's what a lot of people
That's a good distinction.
A lot of people, I'm cool just being a YouTuber. You know, you guys know how much I love this. I'll die for this platform.
Yeah.
This is the greatest thing that ever happened to me. But when people are like, oh, Jimmy's not a good storyteller. He just knows how to manipulate the YouTube algorithm. It's like, come on. Like, watch our, I mean, yes, in years past, like if you watch a video from 3 years ago of mine, or even probably 2 years ago, it's horrible. There is no story. But if you watch our videos in the last year, and you know, and you say like, oh, there's no story here. These are just, you know, manipulating the algorithm. I just disagree. I think we've gotten so much better at getting you to know contestants. Like 100 Days Trapped Together with Bailey and Susie.
Yeah.
I think that's a phenomenal great video. And so, but also now, I don't know, I'm a little competitive. And it's you know, a lot of these people in the, like on the traditional side will be like, okay, well, you can do that on YouTube, but you couldn't do that in our world. And that's where that like slowly, if you would have asked me this when we first did our first podcast, I would have been like, I don't care at all.
That's what you said. You did.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Like we could play a clip of that.
Not even 1% care. But it's like, as we've, especially the last 18 months, gone this path, down this path of like storytelling and studying all this stuff and like getting people connected to characters, I've just learned so much that it's like, I want the hard part about a YouTube video is it's just like 30 minutes and you have 30 minutes to build someone up and then you have to wrap it up. And it's hard to do like multiple arcs and all this stuff when it's just like one video. It has to start and finish there. And it's like, as I've been studying and learning all these things, I want to like apply this like creative stuff I'm learning, but at a grander scale. And it's just, I don't know, right now YouTube serialized content just isn't it.
I really think the biggest difference is appointment viewing. Meaning like when we watch the Super Bowl, the next week we all talk about what we just saw.
Yeah.
And I think with a YouTube video, even though your scale is that of a Super Bowl, or more, people are watching them at different times.
Yep.
Does that make sense? Like when you put out Beat Ronaldo, like that's a great video. I loved that video where you have, you know, different pro athletes going up against average people. But when it's Beast Games and it's coming out on a weekly cadence, there's a different relationship to us discussing those decisions that we just saw that week.
It's also like you just sit down on a streaming platform to like watch a long show, right? Like when I open YouTube, I'm not going into YouTube to sit down and watch a 5 hour show. Like, so if I sit on my couch and I have an hour, I'm opening YouTube. If I sit on my couch and I'm like, I don't want to do anything today, I'm opening, you know, a streaming platform.
But I think it matters if everyone is watching a show at the same time.
Yeah, I think it's a mix of everything we're saying. That a little bit with just expectations coming into it with all these other things combined together is what, I mean, you would think it's fundamentally the same thing, but it just, you know, it just
it's not though, because like somebody could be coming across Squid Game in real life today and watching that and not a part of the conversation that happened when it came out, right? And
well, so, I mean, to even develop on that more, like our Ronaldo video in the first 7 days, I think got 100 million views.
Right.
But that video will go on to probably get 400 million views. So like, three times the amount of people that watch it in the first 7 days will watch it in the next 2 years. So
Right.
Yeah.
And so when a show, when it's eventized and it's coming out week to week, it creates collective conversation, which is a very different human experience.
Yeah.
And I think that's why, just back to the original point of like, why YouTube versus a streaming?
Which you could do. You could do weekly drops of a big show on YouTube.
You could,
but it's just not the same because, like, what if it recommends episode 5 to someone?
It's a recommendations
option. Yeah, and streaming platforms have the autoplay. It's just set up for it better. And then the big thing is it's the expectation the viewers come into it. Like, a viewer's not coming onto YouTube to watch a 10 episode series, but they are on a streaming platform, and that mindset means everything. Like, and it's just. And the recommendation algorithm, like if you click off halfway through through episode 2 of a 10 episode thing, you know, YouTube might interpret that as like, oh, I found this kind of boring, let's stop recommending it. But, you know, you just watched episode 1 and you're like an hour deep in this and you're just wanting to pick it up later. Whereas like, obviously a streaming platform, you know, has all this data and can comp it to other shows and tell like, no, he likes this show, we're going to keep serving it to them, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Today's episode is sponsored by our friends at Spotter Studio. Spotter Studio is an AI-powered software that's been developed hand-in-hand with the top YouTube creators. So here's how it works. It connects directly to your YouTube channel, so it helps you brainstorm ideas based off your top-performing videos. You can either type in an idea, or you can just click the Go button, and it'll give you ideas based on your best-performing videos, as well as the best-performing videos on YouTube. Once you get to a title that you like, you can brainstorm a ton of different thumbnails. You can choose between 3 different styles. You can either do sketch, concept art or realistic. You can even test what it looks like across different YouTube UIs. So you can test it on mobile, in dark mode, light mode, TV, across desktop, search, suggested, and home. Now, these mockups for thumbnails give you unique direction that you can take when you're shooting and designing your thumbnails. Like, we got this idea from Spotter Studio for our video about the future of YouTube. We turned that into this thumbnail, and that thumbnail was one of our highest click-through rates on the channel. Now, this software is so specific to the needs of YouTube creators because the Spotter team spends so much time with creators to develop their products. At the beginning of this year, we helped co-host the third annual Spotter Creator Summit and spent a lot of time talking about how this software can help the future of creators. So if you're a YouTube creator and you're serious about growing your channel, you know that ideas, titles, and thumbnails are the most important part of growing a channel. And there's no better software to do that than Spotter Studio. Click the link in our description. You can get 60 days totally free. Give Spotter Studio a try. And now back to the show. That's also another major difference here is marketing the show. Because like on YouTube, you could solve marketing through a title and thumbnail, right? Meaning like that is our marketing.
Yeah.
It's like, let's make a great thumbnail. But in this context, you actually have to eventize this in a different way. And you have to carry it. I think I saw, and I could be wrong here or not allowed to put this in, but I think I saw the last episode goes live on February 13th.
Yeah, yeah. It's we drop episode 1 and 2 on December 19th, and there's just weekly drops. So 8 weeks after that, yeah.
So for 8 weeks, you're carrying an audience on one story.
Yeah.
It's a very different marketing problem than a YouTube video.
Yeah. Right?
Like, have you thought about that? Of like, are you just thinking, okay, as long as I get enough people in the door in episode one, I'll carry them through episode 10? Or do you think about week to week from now?
Oh, yeah, we have lots of marketing plan between now and the end of it. But at the end of the day, like, it doesn't matter how good your marketing is if the show sucks. The show. It's like, it's around episode 3, which I think, the more I see data, I think when I do season 2, I'll want to drop with episode 1, 2, and 3, not just 1 and 2. If people watch the first 3 episodes of a show and like really enjoy it, they have like a 70% chance of finishing it. It's like a pretty high completion rate. So it's like, that's kind of the golden numbers. First 3, enjoy it, and then they're hooked, and they're gonna want to know what happens.
Got it. I mean, unless the end of episode 2 is insane though.
Yeah,
it's so, it like, might hopefully be that should hook people in.
I know, at the end of episode 2 might be the
it's totally
greatest
nuts.
Thing like. Oh, the greatest cliffhanger of all time. Like,
which so begs good. The question. So we're putting this out when it's already been put out. And at the end of episode 2, this meter of money is just going up and up and up. And it like crosses over $1 million. And if these team leaders choose to press the button, then they get that money. And that's it. But you don't know.
And they stay in the game.
And they stay in the game. But you don't know at the end of episode 2 if they hit the button. It sounds like they do. You don't know.
You'll see in episode 3.
But also just begs the question of like, this meter is just going up and up and up and up and up and up and up.
Yeah.
And these episodes are so expensive.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And like, we know you had a massive budget for this, but we also know you spent a shit ton of money.
I went over budget.
You went over budget.
I lost tens of millions of dollars.
So like, how does this fit into the Mr. Beast business?
Oh.
Like, I know how YouTube fits into the business very well.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can take a loss. You can take a loss on YouTube because of all like you're promoting Feastables, like building a library. There's so many reasons why on YouTube you can do that. But why in this context?
Yeah. Do you look at it as like a startup where it's like, oh, Mr. Beast on streaming is a startup and we may lose some money at the beginning?
Yeah. Well, let me think on it. Cause I think for me, I guess for everything we're doing, we kind of have, I guess everything we're doing is kind of like content. Like it fits in 3 buckets. Like we have our studio, which is like the show, YouTube, all the social media platforms. We have CPG, which is consumer packaged goods, which would be like Feastables and Lunchly. And then the third bucket we've been working on a lot recently is like software, doing things like ViewStats and stuff like that, because we have a very global audience. And even Feastables that I've been doing for years now, most of my audience can't buy it because it just takes forever to scale up. So I wanted to do more digital things. And I think like, I mean, in the studio, I just want to tell great stories, make people feel things, and like this is a great avenue for that, and connect with people. And it's just like there are just some people who only watch streaming platforms and just don't watch much YouTube. Like their time on a streaming platform is, you know, way higher than their time on YouTube. Just like there are people who you spend a ton of time on TikTok and don't spend much time on Shorts. And so like if you're not on TikTok, then you know, people like they're like, if you're not posting on TikTok, they're not going to know you exist in terms of short form content. You could post all the reels you want, all the shorts you want, but there are just people who only consume it there. And so being on every different way people consume content and making the best of the best of the best of content in that vertical is very important to me, so we can reach a lot of these people.
And the reach matters because of the CPG.
Yeah, because products. Of CPG and software. And like for us, CPG, it's obviously Feastables. I mean, I've talked on it here a bunch, but I think Feastables I've also really fallen in love with in the past year. I mean, we've talked about this a billion times because of the ethical sourcing side. Like when I got into chocolate, I didn't realize how just messed up, you know, sourcing cocoa from West Africa is, and how there's over a million kids in child labor in West Africa on cocoa farms. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Yeah.
And when I had been running a chocolate company for a while, and I didn't even know any of that because everyone just kind of like paints it as not a big deal. And I'm like, what? Like, why is everyone acting like this isn't a problem? And so like which is funny because this year has been very hectic for me, which is why I haven't been sleeping much, because a good chunk of 2024 was the Prime show. But also I've been to Africa quite a bit and focusing a lot on just like getting kids out of child labor, because it's just crazy that that's just an acceptable thing in cocoa. So that, like, I think at the start of this, like probably the first half of this year, I probably spent on average like 5 or 6 hours a day working on ethical sourcing. And then I spent hours a day on the Prime show. And then I still have my normal YouTube channel on top of it. So I was dying. I was probably like, I think there was a month where I probably averaged like 4 hours of sleep. It was not healthy, but there's just too much stuff to do.
Probably saw you at that time.
Yeah, I was losing my mind. Yeah. I was going a little crazy.
How do you solve that?
Well, but to wrap that up though, but so it's like I think, cause you asked how it all fits together.
Yeah.
And I want to do, like in general, I want to do things that just make the world better. And so I think with Feastables, I feel really happy about that. Like if we can build a large chocolate company and prove you don't need to use child labor while being profitable, then I can come on things like this and go, hey, big chocolate companies, why do you use child labor? You can not use child labor and do it profitably. And I want to use Feastables as a way to, you know, make change there. And then like with ViewStats on the software side, I mean, I think that speaks for itself. You guys put it in one of your recent videos. Mm-hmm. Yeah. ViewStats is like our version of our Social Blade, where you can see data. I don't want to help creators make more money, blah, 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 do better. And so I just want to build these businesses that are a net positive and then use the studio to get the attention to grow them. And so this is just another avenue to make that happen.
How do you, because when you say you want to do everything that makes a net positive, I feel like there's so many, like the voices in my head of people being like, he doesn't want to do a net positive. He just like is competitive and capitalistic. Like,
yeah.
How do you explain the duality of yourself of like, no, yeah, I do want to do a net positive, and I'm also like competitive and I really like entrepreneurship.
Well, I think that's where a lot of people, they try to make things binary. Like this person is motivated by blank and nothing else. And in reality, that's just not how humans work. You know what I mean? You can be motivated by a ton of different things. And like everyone wants to say like, oh, this person's motivated by money. Okay. And I'm sure they have other motivations as well. You don't do things just for one thing. You know what I mean? Like, and like you're married, right? Yeah. Yeah. You don't just love your wife because of one thing, right? Because she's great or because she's attractive. You love her probably because you probably list 200 reasons why, 2000 reasons why.
Right.
And if I just try to boil it down to, he just loves his wife because she has a good personality, or he just loves his wife because she's attractive. That just doesn't make any sense. And so why do we do that same thing here with this thing that, you know, for people like me, you're spending 15 hours a day on? Like, obviously I'm going to have more than one motivation for it. So yeah, I love building businesses. Shocker. Like that is one of the things that like makes me excited. It's so much fun to just build and solve. Like building a business is solving problems, right? And the bigger it is, the harder the problems are. And I love solving problems. Like that's one of the, like I love having a stimulated brain. I love obsessing over really complex things and coming to solutions. And so that's all building a business is. It's like taking something from $0 a year in revenue to $100 million a year in revenue is essentially 10,000 problems. And and they just get harder and harder, like a video game. And for me, that's fun.
You enjoy strategy games.
Yeah. So strategy and problem solving is one thing, which you could sum up as being competitive. But then, yeah, I also like winning. And I have all these things that, yeah, truthfully, like motivate me or I find fun that aren't about making a positive impact. But then once you take all that and you use it for something positive, it just makes it more fun. Like, and this is what I've always said with making YouTube videos, like, you know, I can make anything go viral, but to be honest, even like the videos where I build wells or help blind people, those usually underperform compared to my other videos. But it's just like a world where I leverage everything I know to do something, you know, good is better than a world where I don't. It's not like does that make sense? And it's just like, if I'm going to spend the next 50 years of my life building businesses, like I want to build ones that are net positives. You know what I mean? It's just like, it more fun. I think it will increase the probability that when I'm 70 and I look back, I'll go, I'm happy with what I did with my life. You know, I did. Yeah. And so if I can solve intense, complex problems and build large companies that I enjoy while doing stuff that makes the world a better place, then it's like, I think that is a life I can live and I won't regret. And so
you're building though to the point now, over the past 5 years since we've known each other, like you have now crossed over to the point of a massive brand.
Yeah.
And massive brands in the world are never seen as
I know.
Like
I know where you're going with it. Yeah. Things.
They just aren't, right? Like a lot of them are, they are nuanced and they do good, but they're also viewed as from the public.
Yeah.
As like, you know, mega corporations that are negative and that feed into like capitalism and whatnot. So it does feel like as you get bigger, the challenge of you coming forward and being like, I'm a nuanced, complex guy who likes all things.
Yeah.
Is going to get increasingly more challenging.
100%.
Because people see things in.
And it is what it is.
Like you're becoming like Coca-Cola or like Procter and Gamble. You know what I'm saying? Like
that. Well, and that, Coca-Cola is a bad one, but yeah, I mean, coming like a large company and I mean, what I would say is actions speak louder than words. Name, you know, one chocolate company in America that's working so hard to get tens of thousands of kids out of child labor.
How are you doing that? Like, what's the path to that?
How much time we got? I mean, you want the high level? You want me?
High level.
Okay. Yeah. Cause summarize essentially, the reason why there's a lot of child labor in West Africa, which is where, so Cote d'Ivoire and Ghana are two countries on the left side of Africa where most of the world's cocoa comes from. It's like 60 or 70%. So that's where, if you're eating a chocolate bar, more than likely that's where the cocoa for the chocolate bar came from. And over there, because chocolate companies have squeezed them dry so much, like farmers make so little that they literally, you know, in many cases can't afford to pay people that aren't kids to work on the farms. Like they just actually can't afford someone who's over 18. So it's the number one cause of child labor is just poverty. Like they just don't make enough money. So at its, at least in the cocoa supply chain, I don't know about other ones, but so at its root, if you want to, I mean, if you want to stop child labor on your farms, you have to pay the farmers more money. So with Feastables, we, when I first started getting into all this, like whatever, I think I've probably been obsessing over it now, like 18 months. I met a company called Tony's Chocolonely. They're phenomenal company.
They're awesome.
Yeah, yeah, they're great. And so I started off by, because this is what you do. When you want to learn something new, you find who's the best in the world at it. You go to them, you obsess, and you just absorb everything they have and, you know, go, you know, talk to journalists. And so I talked to a lot of journalists who have been very critical of the cocoa industry and then ones who are very positive about it. You talk to experts in different fields. You talk to people that work in different chocolate companies. You talk to every charity in it. You just go and absorb all this knowledge. I did. And Tony's Chocolonely, which is like, you know, the largest ethically sourced chocolate company in Europe. They're phenomenal. They had all the answers and they've been living and breathing this the past 15 years. So at the start, a lot of what we're doing is just doing what they're doing. And we formed a joint company with them where Feastables is sourcing their cocoa beans through Tony's
supply chain. Have like a joint sourcing company.
Yeah. They call it Tony's Open Chain that we source not all of our Feastables beans, but majority through.
Oh, interesting.
And then we're also, because the thing is, to stand up a program like they have would takes a very, very long time. Because you got to hire people on the ground. You have to hire farm inspectors to go and audit the farms and CLRMRS and all this other stuff. So we're building, but it just takes time. So we're sourcing majority of our beans through Tony's Open Chain supply chain. And then a small amount we're doing on our own and setting up our own ethical supply chain. But at its core, you got to pay the farmers more. But how do you decide what's enough? Like what's enough where they can hire someone who's not 18, or sorry, over 18, not under 18. And so that's where they have this living income reference price where they look at like the cost of bread and all the things you need to live in West Africa. And they come up with, you know, per a metric ton or like a shipping container of cocoa beans, a farmer needs to make blank based off of inflation, food, and all these other things. And if they make under blank, it's not reasonable for them to be able to live and blah, blah. So that's called a living income reference price. And so with 100% of our farmers and Feastables, we guarantee them a living income reference price. So if you're a farmer in West Africa and you go, you know, you harvest your entire farm, and you're like, here's a shipping container of cocoa. I'm going to make up a number. I want $1,000. We'll go, hey, you want $1,200. And pay you $1,200 because we don't want you using child labor, and this is what you need.
Because you know it's impossible at $1,000.
Yeah, exactly.
Not to do
to make a living income. Yeah. So we'll actually pay more if we need to if they make under the living income reference price. So that at its core, 100% of Feastables is fair trade certified, which is blah, blah, blah. Google it if you want to know what that is. We'll be here a long time if I go in depth. And then on top of fair trade certification, 100% of our farmers, we pay a living income reference price. So they actually make enough money in exchange for these things and a lot of other stuff on top. Because another, to address poverty, you don't just pay them more money, but you also help them increase their yield. So we have coaches that help these farmers increase yield. Because if you can help them get 10% more cocoa per hectare of trees, then that's 10% more money as well. So we have coaches that help them get more yield, help them have less trees get disease, blah, 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 make sure they're doing everything correctly. So all these things, you work with them to help them generate more money, make more income. And then in exchange for all these things, it's like, hey, we don't want kids working on our cocoa farms, and then you have to audit the farms. You send people in to inspect them. And then, if there is a case where there is child labor, they have to remediate it and you check back in the future. And if they don't remediate it, then you drop the farm. But it's like, we're not trying to just be like, oh, you have child labor, drop them, never talk to them again, because that would screw them over. So it's like educating them why this is bad. Like, hey, you want your kid to get an education. You don't want them to have to work on a farm forever. Like, so they need to do this. And so like, we're going to check in on the future. We really need this kid to go to school and not be working on this farm. And here's all these guidelines. Work with us so we can keep buying from you and paying you this premium and all this stuff. And not taking an approach of, oh, nope, bad, and kick them to the curve. And so it's like, it's really in depth, a lot of stuff like that. And like, Feastables is the largest ethically sourced chocolate company in America. I mean, I there's not a chocolate company in America that is doing the kind of revenue we're doing and anywhere near as ethically sourced as we are. I mean, I can't even think of a large chocolate company in America that pays their farmers a living income. So I think it's very important for Feastables to succeed and do well, because I mean, there's over 1 million kids in West Africa that would benefit from it. And if we can get it where Feastables is doing over $1 billion a year in revenue while, paying our farmers a living income, while doing all these ethical things, then, and while being profitable, big one is while still being profitable. Because if we're doing all these things and losing money, because it's very expensive, like we're building schools in West, because a problem I run into with some of our farms is we'll be like, hey, I don't want this kid working on your farm, put him in school. And they're like, there's no school in our village. I'm like, fuck. We're building schools in West Africa. It's a lot. I'm trying to bring in some other nonprofits to help us out, and ones that build schools. Be like, hey, can you build schools here in this village? Because I'm getting all these kids out of child labor and I need a school for them to go to, and not I got to build it, but I don't have that kind of money. And it's like getting, it's
You really took the simplicity of launching a YouTube channel and
that's not what I thought I was getting into when I sold chocolate. I just thought it was selling chocolate.
Who you are.
But then I'm just like, well, I'm gonna keep selling chocolate, but I don't want to use child labor. So fuck it, I gotta solve it. But to wrap that up though, it's like with Feastables, if I think because the problem now, for us, not problem, we're getting pretty big, but a lot of these, they're chocolate companies that sell per day 50 times more chocolate bars than we do. So they'll, they can say, well, yeah, if we did a little volume like you, we could ethically source, but you don't understand, Jimmy. Yeah. We're much bigger. That stuff doesn't work on scale. So I got to get to the point where we're actually large, where I can go, no, look, we did achieve scale while doing these ethical things. Fuck you, stop using child labor. And if you don't, I'm going to start blasting you on my YouTube channel, which I don't currently do it because I don't think we're big enough yet where we can prove these things. And I really want to get things fleshed out to a crazy level where, they can poke. Because the second I start going at other companies for using child labor and being unethical and and not trying to stop it, they're obviously going to just come at us super hardcore. And so I want to make sure everything with Feastables is perfect before I do. So we can just be like, look, here it is, it's working. And I'd also prefer not to get to this thing where I'm slamming other brands. Rather they just be like, you know what, we want to ethically source as well. You're doing it profitably, teach us. And we work behind the scenes to help them out and that kind of stuff, which would be the best outcome.
Right.
But we know that's not going to be the outcome, but it would be ideal. Blah, blah, blah. So that's been, it's funny, while I'm making YouTube videos and the show, that's my third life. And it's, the crazy part is setting all this up takes forever. And I didn't want to be like, hey, I am doing this, I'm going to do this, because that feels weird. I was just like, you know what, screw it. I'm just not going to say anything publicly and I'm just going to work on this. And however long it takes. And I'm probably closing in on 18 months now. And I didn't even really mention this publicly to another podcast a week ago. So it's kind of crazy that it's been such a large part of my life and I've never even spoke about it publicly. And even now we're still building a lot of the things. We haven't even finished a single school in West Africa. Well, not in for Feastables hasn't. I mean, Beast Philanthropy's built schools, but not for our farms. And a lot of the things I want to do just take time. And so it's this is probably like the next 5 to 10 years of my life going to be pretty intensely revolved around this.
What have you learned about scaling companies in this process? Because like there's this massive spectrum for YouTube creators of like, you know, the Ryan Trahans on one side of like, I have a couple employees or, you know, a few employees or whatever, and I'm really close to every edit.
Yeah.
And then there's you who's like, I'm actually scaling so much that I'm taking on the responsibility of building schools in West Africa for my CPG brand, which is truly the far end of the spectrum.
Yeah, it's
so like you, like when we used to sit down with you, it was like AVD, CTR, here's the metrics you need to know about YouTube. Here's how you do storytelling.
Yeah.
But now we don't talk about that stuff.
Yeah.
Because you've scaled.
Yeah.
What have you learned about scaling? Like
I mean, the shortest answer, it's hard. I do not recommend, I think a lot of creators obviously try to do what I do. And I know your audience is almost all creators. It's very, very difficult, especially because so many creators now are launching CPG brands. And I mean, you see them, they go, whoop, and then they nosedive, they go up and down.
It's a very like attractive thing to do as a creator, because like the base premise is, because I have an audience, I can have a lower customer acquisition cost on a product.
Yeah.
Right? That's the base premise. And that sounds
Thing is, it's like almost everyone is not making products that are better than what's out there. Most best case are making something that's just parody what's out there.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's like there's so much more to a company, like especially a CPG company, than just having a product. It's like, you know, putting it on the shelf, knowing the right pricing, knowing the right, you know, SKUs, and like, you know, even especially if you get into beverage, DSD, like direct service delivery and all that kind of stuff. And there's just, it's like if some, you know, movie star, I mean, actually, this is a great example. If like some famous movie star was like, yeah, I have all these people who love watching my movies. YouTube's easy. I'll just, you know, spend a couple hours a week making YouTube videos. Surely I'll be one of the biggest YouTubers, which we've seen a million times and it never, ever, ever worked. Yeah. It's the same way people in CPG look at creators. They're like, oh, fucking idiots. Like they don't, like just how we would look at movie stars coming over, you know, and be like, that is just the most lazy mid content ever. That's never going to do well. And it doesn't.
That's a good
It's like, that's exactly how the people in the CPG world, when I look at them, they're talk to them, they're like, wow, that's like a fine product, but they're like literally doing nothing right. Like, what do you like? And these are things that, you would think it's as simple as just put a product on a shelf, people buy it, but it's not. There's so much more to it. Just like making a YouTube video isn't just turn on a camera and hit record. Yeah. And so I would highly recommend for most creators, almost every, like Feastables now, I don't know where it's at, maybe 100 employees, but I mean, I'm hiring so many people in West Africa, but even if you ignore all the ethical sourcing, I just want to make my life easier. Just scaling the chocolate company and like, you know, inventory management and all these other things we're doing in margin profile, which, you know, like for us, like going into whether we sell like, here's one, right? Like our normal bars are 60 gram, right? There's 12 gram bars you can put in pouches, like Halloween bag ones, or we could do like a Popple, like our own version of like an M&M or something, right? Both are miniature versions of what we sell. But which one do you go into? Right? Those are big decisions. And like, you know, there's a theoretical fork in the road where one, you know, could sell $100 million a year and one could sell 10. And your decision can make that big of a difference. You know what I mean? And it's like, there's all these micro decisions you're making. And if you're not living and breathing and obsessed with it, you're just going to fuck it up, because you're competing against, just like on YouTube, you're competing against, you know, or I guess social media in general, you're competing against Speed, you're competing against Kai, you're not even just competing against me, you're competing against all these freaks that live and breathe this. And CBG, it's the same way. There are thousands of monsters that this is all they've done for the last 30 years. This is what they live and breathe. And if you think just on a whim, you're just going to make better product decisions, better placement decisions, better, you're just not, you know. So it's one of those things where you're either all in, which then is the problem, is if you go all in on that, you're just going to destroy your channel, because most people aren't like me and have all these employees and infrastructure set up and blah, blah, blah. And you shouldn't go all in unless you're just planning on quitting to be a creator, but that doesn't make any sense, because that's the reason they got into it. So then I think for almost everyone, it makes sense to partner with someone who is an expert in the field, have them run the business, and you just kind of do the marketing and that kind of stuff. I think that makes sense. But anything past that, you're just going to destroy your YouTube channel, or it's just going to fail. Because a business isn't like, if you, let's say you launched, let me think of a product no one's launched, so they don't think I'm targeting them. Let's say you launched peanut jelly, like bottle of jelly. A bottle of jelly, you know, sure, you can get a lot of people to buy a bottle of jelly once. You can. And we've seen that with influencer products, but that's not a business. A business is getting someone to buy that bottle of jelly every 2 months for the next 10 years.
Right.
That's a business. And basically every creator company minus Prime, you know, Feastables, Lunchly, and maybe one or two others, like they don't, they just get that. You literally just see in their sales graphs goes up and then it nosedives. And that's not it, like at that point, just do a brand deal. If you're a creator, like why start a business? You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think just because of the attractiveness of it, because it sounds like, I think everyone is looking for, can I get equity in a thing and then that sells and I make a large sum of money, right? Everyone's looking for a big
can people, can I de-risk myself from
the And people side only of buy the companies because it has consistent repeat purchase rate over long terms, and they believe if they acquire that company years in the future, they'll be getting the cash flow off the repeat sales.
Right.
And no, that is why they're sales. It's not sales just because, which like the thing is, you know, it's not all creators' faults. It's also like the companies that are working with creators and getting them to start these, and they're not educating the creators. They make it seem like, oh yeah, you just build a business, you just sell a couple $1 million and then people pay 5x that and there you go, you made 10 million bucks. And it's like, no, like they're only, investors are only going to pay that kind of money if they believe you're going to keep doing those sales and growing year over year. You know, because like, let's say you do theoretically 2 million in revenue and you have 10% EBITDA, so you make $200,000. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like if someone's, you know, like if you think someone's going to pay $10 million for that business, you know, at your current rate, even if sales stayed steady, that would take 50 years for them to make that 10 million back. The reason people pay crazy multiples is because if you're 2 million, but you're projected to do 3 million the next year and then 5 million and then 6 and then, you know, 4 years from now, 10 million. Well, now it's like, if you look 4 years in the future, you're doing a million, you're spinning off a million of free cash. That's only 10 years to recoup. And then if, you know, you assume 30% growth, and it makes sense. If a business is growing fast while having good margin, then like acquisitions make sense, but that's not what's happening with a lot of these creator brands, and the repeat purchase rate isn't there. So there's just never going
to
be an acquisition.
And there's not much money to make along the way.
Yeah. And that's why I just wish someone would educate a lot of these creators, because then the problem is you spend all this money on inventory and just like with a new startup, you burn so much cash, you mess so many things up. Like I messed a bajillion things up with Feastables. Like we launched with the like wrong boxes where the bars were falling out of the boxes. I think I've told the story before. Yeah. It was horrible. And that cost me tens of millions of dollars to fix. And it was a really bad thing. And like a lot of creators, you know, make all these mistakes and the repeat purchase rate is there and they end up not making anything or very little. Mm. And it's like, if they, like, instead of launching a jelly company, just did a partnership with the jelly company, not even for equity, just for brand deals. Yeah. So it's like the difference over a 4 year spectrum of like doing, I mean, for like a, I don't know, like a creator with 10 million subscribers, it's like they could get paid theoretically, we'll say 50 grand a video to promote this jelly. And let's say they do like fucking 7 promotions a year, that's 350,000 times 7, you know, that's how much money they could have in their bank account. Whereas if they launch a jelly company, they spend all this money on inventory, they make all these mistakes, and then 4 years later, no one's buying it and they shut the company down. It's like one scenario, you know, they basically have $0 or lose money. In the other scenario, they just did brand deals risk-free. They had more time to put in through content so their videos do better, and they're walking away with $1.5 million. It's like, and it hurts to see so many creators just ruin that, you know, because they're just, I think in a lot of times, it's just they're not getting advice from the right people. And a lot of managers or companies just are taking advantage of creators because they're just not business savvy. Like they didn't get big on YouTube because they know how to run a business. They got big on YouTube because they know how to make great videos, and they're trusting business people who aren't giving them the real picture.
Right. So let's talk about that then. If the trajectory is not getting into like CPG products, and it might be getting deeper in the world of content, because we're, you know, creators are great at making content. So let's talk about this intersection of YouTube and streamers, because you experience this now firsthand, right? With Prime Video and Beast Games. Do you believe that that is a future for creators?
Ooh.
Why or why not? Like, are we, do we get the opportunity in a year from now to explore, like, is Netflix calling creators now? Is Prime Video calling more creators?
In what world would you recommend that we do it?
Yeah. It's hard. I think it should be because you want to do it, right? Like that at its core, because again, you have to maintain your YouTube channel, or what's the point if you just kill, you know, the thing that's feeding you? So if it's something a creator really wants to do, then yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. Like we talked about before, it's a way to go deeper with your audience, provide something different, and truthfully, there's just a lot of money in streaming. Like, I didn't make any money off my show, but, you know, if I wanted to, I could have made a lot of money. And like, I think for, it could be, it's obviously a great way to diversify. Great. It's just all around. Yeah. It's if you can do it without destroying your YouTube channel, then yeah, it's a no brainer for a lot of creators. It's just doing it well is not as straightforward. You know, a lot of people go to do streaming shows and then they just, bring in people who normally do streaming shows and give them control. And then they lose what makes their channel special and the soul or what their community likes. And then it ends up flopping and being a giant waste of time. So it's just like, you just gotta make sure you do it right. Right. Cause like, you know, if someone tried, like if a Minecraft Let's Player wanted to make beast games, that's like, A, that's not why people watch that Minecraft Let's Player.
Right.
Right. And B, they would just suck and it would flop because they've never done something like that. And so I think streaming shows make sense if you take what your community loves about you and why your community likes you, plus your area of expertise and zone of genius, and then you modify it towards a streaming show. Not, I think that is a formula that will work. But when you try to be something you're not, do something that is not why your community likes you, and do a streaming show. I think that's why there's been so many flops in the past. And it's like, on paper, it's like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, this person has so many followers, so many people love this person. Why the hell aren't they watching the show? And it's like, that's not, that show isn't what they're good at. That's not the kind of content they know well. And that's not what their community wants. So it flopped, you know.
Do you think Prime Video or Netflix,
Prime Video,
would ever open up like a creator program where they essentially say, you're an approved creator, you can upload to our platform.
Here's our specs, here's what we need.
And and we'll give you a share of subscription based on the viewership you drive.
I mean, I could call them and ask. I mean, I'm sure they...
Or do you think that would be a good... Because like the question obviously is the cost of programming is getting really high on streaming platforms, right? Especially when you're working with like legacy actors. That's like talent fees can be through the roof for that, right? So you can end up spending millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars on programming. But YouTube obviously has this incredible model of like...
Yeah, I think to just answer it though, it's the problem is like, it's available on YouTube for free. And so like, it's not that valuable. I know a lot of creators who have gone to streaming platforms and been like, hey, how much would you pay me to put my catalog up there? And it's like, it's funny because some of them will call me and be like, I think I can get like $500,000 per YouTube video to put it on Netflix because I'm getting this many views or blah, blah, blah. Or I won't even say a streaming platform. Yeah. And I'll be like, yeah, they're just not going to pay that. Like unless, especially if you're not doing exclusive. It's like, no, we get this. And then like, they'll call me back a week later and they'll be like, yeah, it was like 30 grand.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, I guess the only reason it would be if the economics of share of subscription revenue was higher than the economics of.
Yeah, but they don't share subscription revenue. They just pay flat fees. Yeah.
Right.
So that's because why that the subscription revenue is like all the upside for them. So that's how they make money is they think, oh, this show is going to get 20,000 people to subscribe and the LTV of that is blank. So we're going to pay them, you know, you blank and over 3 years we'll quadruple our money.
I know you listened to our Dude Perfect episode.
So good.
Would you ever do something similar to what they're doing with the Dude Perfect app where it's like you get your own app, you're selling your own app?
I'm going to be honest. I didn't know that was... Well, I knew it was a thing, but I didn't know how big it was to your episode. Yeah. Like I called their CEO after that episode and talked to him and I was like, yo, tell me more about this app. That was very fascinating. That was one of your better episodes. I texted Samir afterwards. Yeah. I was like, that was good.
That was high praise. That was probably in the same vein as like, I would be terrified to send any of our videos to Casey Neistat. I think that's like you do is like that. That to me is like terrifying. Like even the BTS video we did together, like, I like to see his storytelling notes would be terrifying. But
especially too close to the release. Yeah, I would need a good like.
I'll send it to him an hour before you drop it, and like here's all of Casey's notes.
That would stress me out so much.
I think I'd quit.
Yeah, but you texting me about the Dude Perfect thing was a similar experience of like, okay, Jimmy liked that. I'm really happy to hear that.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, I don't know if smaller creators liked it, but as someone because they're doing very similar things to me, I was like, this really hit home. But I don't know about the doing an app like that. I've got enough going on right now. I really want to solve, you know, ethical sourcing Feastables, and I want to LaunchLee keep improving the SKUs and then view stats and keep helping creators. And then I really want to make a video game. So those things plus everything we're doing in the studio, like that's kind of enough for me at the moment. And I feel like my brain is always stimulated and I always have plenty of stuff to work on. So, but I know a couple of creators who are on that app and they say they're like making pretty good money. It's going really well. So I'm like kind of surprised.
What does it mean for Beast Games to be ROI positive for you and for Prime Video?
Well, it's not going to be in the terms of money, it won't be ROI positive.
But let's say like in terms of brand or in terms of like, what does it mean if it's successful?
But it might be if there's a year two or a year three and it becomes a whole
thing. It could eventually.
Whatever they pay me for season two and three, I'm just going to reinvest. I hope I break even on season two and three, but that's not, I'm not good at breaking even.
It's not your vibe.
But I get you. What is, I guess, success.
Like success. Or, yeah. On both sides.
Well, I guess at its core, like at the high part of the Mount Everest is, do people watch the show and obviously enjoy it, right? That is success. I think I said it earlier, but do people get connected to the contestants? Do they feel like they know them? Do they, I guess this is more success on my side. I mean, Prime Video probably cares about these things, but ultimately they have data and analytics. Sure. But on my side, do people watch the show, get to know the contestants, love them, and just feel things? You know, that's what the wave I've been on the last 18 months is like making people feel things and telling stories and less about retention, data, analytics. Because if people feel stuff and like know that like they can watch this and it's going to give them emotions, then they're like, that to me is a win. But obviously, there's not just one singular thing. So that's one. I mean, obviously, I want Beast Games to be the biggest competition reality show to ever exist. Like, so I don't think that's going to happen with season one, but hopefully.
That means by viewership or by what?
I don't really know what that means. I just want to win.
By like brand?
I guess. I haven't really thought that far. I just know I want it to be the biggest. I guess views. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And so, which again, I don't think season one will do that. But I think over time, that would be a success for Beast Games is that this, you know, it's just people are like, wow, I can't find anything like this. Like just kind of like on YouTube, like there's a lot of great content, but in terms of like big spectacles, like you just can't find anything even a third as big as ours anywhere else. And so people are like, wow. And they keep coming back. This is great. I can't find this anywhere else. I want that. But there are a lot of people every year that watch competition shows, that watch reality shows, like tens of millions of people. I want those tens of millions of people to be like, damn, I've been watching competition shows for decades. Yeah. And none of them were even anywhere near Beast Games level. This is my new thing. This changed everything. So that, and then obviously, you know, I want to break any records we can on viewership. Yeah. This is so funny. Because if you compare our interview now to like the first interview we did, I'm going to seem like such a different person. But I think success on my side too would be, I'd love to win an Emmy or some kind of award. I think that would be great. Personally, I don't care about awards. I mean, I've won a lot of streamings and I've never even gone, which I feel kind of bad because
I wish you would stop. Phone. You would stop winning.
No. I'm gonna go. I'm gonna go to this next streaming. So I'll go because
what if this is the one you go to and you don't win?
Don't win. It's fine. I don't care. I mean, like if Speed or Kai won one, that'd be cool. Yeah. I think Link when I didn't show up was like said dissed me last year, and I was like, oh, I feel kind of bad. So I'll go. But having said that, I don't care about it, but my team really does. They are like, so like some, like our editor is an example. Yeah. We have some editors who like, they've dreamed for years, like their whole lives of one day winning an Emmy or something like that. And so like, I see their energy and I see that we've now worked on something that could, and I know how much it would mean to them if we did. So like that energy is infectious. And so now I really want to win one just so I can see how happy it would make my team. So, but also I think it would be a good reflection on creators, because if Beast Games wins an Emmy, then it's like, see, creators can make good shows. Creators are fucking awesome. Or, you know, like creators 5 years ago versus creators now are not the same.
It's a totally
like,
different landscape.
Creators are building businesses, like especially in the content world, and like building mini production companies and doing it successfully. So arguably some of the biggest production startups over the last few years, all of them basically have been creators. And so success is ideally winning an award of some type. And then success is, you know, having this crush so other creators can use it and go, look, Jimmy killed it with Beast Games. Give me a good deal. Believe in me and get more creative freedom, get better terms and that kind of stuff with the streaming deal. And on my side, success is a lot of things. I think those are the major ones. On Prime side, it's probably just how many people sign up for Prime Video and, you know, they stick around.
So. What's your advice to both sides? Like, if in the next year more YouTubers get into rooms with streamers and get into negotiations, what's your advice for both sides? Like, how should Hollywood be thinking about working with creators, and how should creators think about working with Hollywood?
Well, we'll start off with the easy one. Hollywood working with creators. you know, when I talked to every platform for our show before we landed with Prime Video. And I mean, there's some pretty dumb things that were said, like even... like I won't name specific platforms because obviously, but like one, they like a high up exec at one of the streaming platforms like was telling me how they did a deal with a different influencer and it's like it didn't do well, and they were like running me through it, and I was like, they're like, what makes you different? And I was like, that person does like a million views a video and has like two employees,
right?
I do 200 million views a video and have a 200 person production team. Why are you, and you're telling me you don't know the difference between me and them? Like, it's just like, oh my gosh, how are you in charge of this? So it's like, for, I was having to do a lot of educating with a lot of these platforms, which, you know, if I'm playing devil's advocate, obviously, in terms of knowledge in the creator space, I'm probably like,
sure,
the top 10, top 3, number 1, maybe. So it's like, I guess it's not fair to expect them to be at my level because this is all I've done with my entire life. But also the fact that someone, when they're talking with me, wasn't in the room on their side that was at that level is just kind of sad. So I think it's a lot of education for them, to be honest. And I would say is like the number one lesson they should take away. And, you know, and one of the biggest reasons why I went with Prime is because they actually watched a lot of my content and were big fans of it. And I wasn't having to go like, hey, I did this. Yeah. And like, and when I say I buried myself alive, they didn't go, you buried yourself alive? It's like, yeah, I've done it 3 times.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, did you even open my channel? You know, so that, you know, that, and then on the creator side, that I have a lot to say. Yeah, it's a big deal when you, it's not just money, right? Like a lot of creators are just thinking how much money I can get, but you know, there are a lot of levers that, there are a lot of instances where you should take less money if it means you get more creative freedom, if it means you own the IP, if it means you get blank, 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 or deciding, you know, do you sell, you know, if you're, let's say, I'm just going to pick a random, let's say, just make up a streaming platform's name, like a one, I don't want to say one because someone might, you know how big clips are.
Make up one.
Yeah, because someone might clip this and then it might seem like I'm talking about something. Like if I was like, you know, when you're negotiating with Netflix, so like what's a fake streaming name I can use?
The Beast app.
Streamflix.
Streamflix.
That's probably might be real, but.
But it's fine. Streamflix, good. That way people can clip this and it doesn't seem like I'm shit talking on a platform. So like, let's say you're negotiating with Streamflix, right? Like, you know, even something as simple as like, what if they try to buy the first 3 seasons, you know, how well do you think season 1 will do? Because if you think season 1 is going to crush and you've never done anything on a streaming platform before, you would make infinitely more money and have more leverage if you just did season 1, you know, and then negotiated season 2 and 3 afterwards, because, you know, like that you would theoretically could get an offer like, we'll give you $5 million for season 1 through 3, you know, upfront to do all of them. But, you know, there's a separate world where you just sell them season 1 for $1.5 million. It crushes, and then you come back and you get $7 million just for season 2 and 3. Now that's a net difference of, you know, 60% just because you believed in yourself and took a risk, right? Like that's a thing that most of these creators wouldn't even think of. And so, but this is just an example of one of the many things that, like, my biggest advice for creators would be like, you don't know how to negotiate these kinds of deals, because that's like a very simple one. Yeah. But then it goes all the way in depth of the IP, the ownership rights of the show, who has control over the edit, to, you know, even like how you have to do the budgeting, the line by line. Like it's these are big like deals, especially the bigger they get. And so there are people who have negotiated hundreds or thousands of these streaming deals on behalf of other people. First thing I would do is get on the phone with them and educate yourself, and then just say, I don't know anything, and let them handle it. And like, you know, and bring experts in. Don't try to negotiate these with your internal team. If you have a manager who has never negotiated a streaming deal or has negotiated less than 100, don't have them negotiate this deal, right? Because they're going to block you into things. They're going to leave money on the table. They're going to not get you the creative control you need. They're just like, yeah, like, I mean, I'm very happy with the deal I got with Amazon, and, you know, and it worked out very well. But, you know, when I saw like some of the stuff the other platforms were putting on the table and in there, like, you know, things that I was like, oh, this isn't a big deal. Like, and but then I would talk to these people who have negotiated lots of these deals, and they'd show me 10 examples of how, you know, other shows left those in and it became a big deal. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know that's what that meant. Yeah. You know, and I negotiate a lot and do a lot of contracts and build businesses for a living. And even there are things like, you know, that that I just know like a normal creator would just get screwed on. So yeah, that's kind of my advice. Yeah.
So we're recording this right before Beast Games comes out.
I know. I almost wish it was after so we could talk about it.
By the time we publish this episode, there will have been tons of reviews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There will be
YouTube
positive ones. YouTube's about to explode.
Yeah.
Positive ones.
Your BTS video will be out. I can't wait to see what people think of that.
There's going to be positive ones. There's going to be negative ones. When you look out, if you had to guess, why do people love it and why do some people hate it? If you had to guess.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the show's phenomenal. I mean, obviously, some people are not going to like it, but I'm not.
But like your deepest fears, like when you send a Casey Neistat and you're like, oh, I hope he likes
it. I guess my deepest fear would be it. Problem is at the start, we have more contestants than any show in history. So the character building doesn't really start till episode 3, but it like really, really doesn't start to like episode 5 or 6, like where you like, actually can name the characters and know them. And so I guess my biggest fear would be that people think how episode 1 and 2 are, it's how all 10 will be. And episode 1 and 2 are phenomenal. But I think like halfway through is when people are just going to be like, wow, this is crazy. I feel like I'm friends with these people. I feel like I know what they're going to do before they do it. And I really, you're going to have people you're rooting for, and it's just going to be great to a level that you never expected. And then on the positive side, I would say, yeah, I mean, I think people are going to be like, how did they build this? How did they do this? I feel like people are going to love it, because it's just like, it's not one of those shows where, like, a lot of times when I watch these kinds of shows, like, I'm struggling to keep up. It's like a chore at certain parts. I'm like forcing myself, because it's like there are great moments in competition reality shows, but a lot of times they're then followed by a lot of boring stuff that, you know, you almost watch on 2x speed, but this isn't that. You're just like, it's good. And so I think people are going to love the way they feel. And if they watch deep enough, they're going to love the way they get to know the contestants like nothing else.
Week to week versus binge. I know we talked about that a bit before.
Yeah.
Was that a decision that came really easy of like, hey, release these three and then we're going to go week to week? Because that to me, again, feels like a big conversation in the world of entertainment of mostly what happened was, you know, the streaming platforms introduced the binge model, which was like, here's a whole season.
Yeah.
Watch the whole thing. But we're also working in a direction, even where creators are doing appointment viewing, Speed or Kai, they market the hell out of their streams. You're going on a stream right after this that's been marketed, like where it's like, show up at this time at this date. So was that a discussion that you guys had between binge and appointment?
Oh, of course. I mean, that was a rough decision to make. I think weekly is the correct play, especially for us, because these episodes are so grand and big. I feel like you almost need time afterwards to digest the volume of stuff that happened, because these are big. And I think the enjoyment of being able to talk to other viewers and you know, if you just binge it and it ends, it's like there's nothing to really discuss. But every week being able to discuss with your friends, like, yo, did you see what this contested? Because there's so much backstabbing. There's so many crazy social experiments. Yeah. And to be able to discuss it, I think will make the viewing experience way more fun. So based on the data I've seen and the more I've thought about it, I think weekly is the way to go. But honestly, time will tell. And maybe season 2, we do the binge model.
You talk about season 2 and 3 quite a bit. Is that something that's like happening or what needs to happen?
No, I probably shouldn't. Yeah. I was told not to talk.
Okay, like, got it.
Definitive. But the thing is, I loved what we did with these games, and I'm doing it now. I loved working with Prime Video, so I'm sure we're going to do it with them.
But the concept of Beast Games, you want to continue.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like there's no world where I'm not.
Like, would you do 1,000 contestants again? Or 2,000 on episode 0.
It was a lot. I see why no one's ever done 1,000. I see why that was a world record.
I mean, I even saw it from them lining up to get into set and out of set. Was such a long process.
Bro, it would take an hour and a half for bathroom.
Yeah, just being there was overwhelming with 1,000.
Yeah.
Like just being there.
I know.
I can't even imagine.
Seeing 1,000 people with so many people, bathroom breaks. The other thing is the GoPros, everyone had a camera. There's footage of a time lapse of your team unboxing 1,000 GoPros.
Really?
I haven't even seen that. It takes so long. Like to do anything times 1,000
is brutal.
Insane.
Yeah. I guess you'll see if it's worth it, right? As it comes out, how people receive it, it's like, was it worth it?
Because it's so much effort. And then inversely, the more people you have, the less depth you can develop.
Yeah. So, or do you pick the top people from your episodes, you know?
So I need the show to drop and I need to see what people think. I'm not opposed to doing 100. I'm not opposed to trying to do 10,000. I need to see what I'll do whatever I think people want. I just need to.
I think probably less. I mean, personally.
Same. I'm leaning towards less now, but you never know.
Because you're right. Like as I've watched through the season, like anything else, you want to know the characters. And it's easier to know when there's less.
Yeah. All that matters is that the characters are good. It's like even with like American Idol, they start with like thousands and thousands and thousands of candidates. Mm-hmm. But they only show you, even in episode 1, the best stories, the people that are going to pretty much make it.
Yeah, and maybe the answer is I do 1,000, but I just hone in on 30 and just ignore the rest. I mean,
at least when it comes to stories, like you know who has the best story.
But I think the sheer spectacle of 1,000 is cool, but I think it's more impactful if it's just like, here's these 100 people and they're vying for this thing.
I agree. Or it might be, you know, instead of, Like we just can people quicker, right? In episode one of season two, maybe we just go from 1,000 to 100. You know,
Maybe in the future, like what happened in episode one in terms of dwindling down actually happens in the first 5 minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is crazy.
In the first 3 minutes of season two of Beast Games, we eliminated 900 people, gave away $5 million and complaining. And that is just in the first 3 minutes of the show.
I think the crazy thing is though, your YouTube videos are like a season of television in one video, like the wilderness video.
Yeah.
That's a season of TV.
I could make an entire show on Prime Video over that. And it would crush. People would love it.
Beat Ronaldo. That is a season of TV. That's Pros versus Joes, you know? Okay. I wanted to show you a clip. We have to get you out of here.
Okay.
Very soon in like 3 minutes. And I want to take some photos, but I just want to show you the opening of Beast Games episode one. And the opening of two of your YouTube videos.
Okay.
Because I thought it was just interesting. You kept saying you wanted more, like you had the opportunity to go slower on Prime Video.
Yeah.
And I was trying to understand what that meant. And then I watched this.
I am standing on $5 million of real money.
The largest grand prize in entertainment history. And competing for this $5 million are these 1,000 contestants.
Okay, so that's the opening of Beast Games episode one.
Behind me are 100 sets of twins, and they're gonna compete for $250,000. Everyone, go to your cube. Out of these 100 pairs of identical twins, only one is walking away with this $250,000. And if either twin crosses the red line, they'll both be eliminated. Let's find out which pair of you is the best set of twins and wins the $250,000.
I have never been around this many.
I mean, you get the point. I'm basically saying that what's really interesting is the opening of Beast Games has no cuts. The first 12 seconds of Beast Games is just you.
I am standing on $5 million.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it doesn't like whoosh into the $5
million. Yeah.
In entertainment history.
Ah, that's such a good shot. Yeah. Fuck yeah.
$5 million are these
1,000 contestants.
But that's I actually think that's more symbolic than people might realize that that is just a shot of you for 12 seconds. You guys never do that.
Not on an intro.
You would never hold on an intro for 12 seconds.
No. And it's just like because on YouTube, you have to, it's just different, man. It's different expectations. It's different. It's like YouTube, you just got to reassure them the title and thumbnail is like a big problem with my YouTube videos is people just don't think they're real. And so like, I have to like show so much at the start and I have to like, you know, I have like this 10 second window to convince someone. I did this. I swear to God, I did it. I swear. I promise. Here's proof. I did it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like it's like in the twins video, 100 twins compete for $250K. It's like here's 100 twins. Look, here's a close up. They're twins. Yeah. There's $250K. That's real money. I'm giving it to them. All right, but now it's like okay, there's twins and money, but are they just gonna stand here? Now, all right, there's cubes. Look, there's this big set. This is a good video. And like on YouTube at the start, you almost have to like beg, you're like, look, I promise what I put in the title thumbnail is real, especially for us because what we do is so big, and you have to convince them of all of it, and then get permission to slow down. With these shows, like I mean, you know, most competition shows are like, you know, a fraction as big as this. And so it's like, and people still sit down and watch. Like people like will give you at least a couple minutes on a show before they give up on it. It's not like 10 seconds out. You know what I mean? Like how, I can't think of a time I've ever clicked on a show and then 10 seconds later clicked off. Like you understand that it takes a little bit of time to get to know what's going on. Yeah. And so you, like what in YouTube you have to do in 20 seconds and streaming you can do in, you know, 3 minutes. And like, that's a huge difference.
I got a question about like what you said about viewers on YouTube think it's not real. So you have to prove that it's real.
Yeah.
I want to ask about the creative choice of using CGI.
Yeah.
Because I feel like CGI, although it looks cool and it's not impacting like the challenge, right? It's not like you're not using it to alter the challenge. You're using it to alter the environment.
To extend sets.
To extend sets.
Yeah.
But I feel like even just using CGI gives ammo to people who are like, oh, it's not real.
Yeah.
Or it takes them out of the realness of it.
100%. And that's where I've thought about this so much. And that's why we very rarely use it. Like we're literally talking about like, I mean, CGI also is incredibly expensive. So it's expensive and like 0.1% of the content we use has it in it. So it's like, but I agree with what you're saying. But then like look at our Squid Game video and imagine if we didn't do like use CGI, like how much like that's like part of what made it so cool and like closed the gap between what happened in the show and what we did. And so I'm cool with never using CGI again. I don't care. Like we build phenomenal sets and I don't want, because we use CGI, people to doubt the authenticity of our videos. And so that's that's something I've thought about a lot. And I wish more creators used it in entertainment video so I could kind of look at how they gauge it and like get inspiration. But I'm kind of trailblazing here. No one else does these big budget YouTube videos. And so we already dial it back way more than traditional does to, you know. I mean, the honest answer is I don't know. I think this is something if you ask me 3 years from now, I'd be like, yeah, this is how you use it and blah, blah. Something I said this on a different podcast, but something I've been thinking a lot about is like maybe watermarking it every time we use CGI. And I've been working with the team to try to figure that out. Like if every time we do something, there's just like a Beast logo that's on the side of it. So you would know if you see that Beast logo, you know, we extended a set or something like that. So it's like, or timestamping in the description.
I think I felt it the most in the city. The wide shot of the city with the moat around it.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I felt it the most. Cause I mean, probably cause I was there.
You were there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's also, you're talking about in Beast Games. Yeah, well, Beast Games. Oh, we were talking about YouTube. I mean, sorry. Beast Games. Yeah. We use it quite a bit, but that's why for Beast Games, we're doing a lot of BTS and we have your video you know, you guys had, Mr. Who's the Boss did the YouTube video because that was a big one. You guys have basically all of episode one, the lead up to it. Yeah. It's great. And then John and a couple other people are taking over the later stuff. So that's why I was so intent on doing BTS because I was like, here's everything that happened. So we're not hiding things because the CG, you know, in Beast Games, like we built the craziest sets in the history of entertainment. Yeah. And I didn't want people to think like that city is CG when it's not. They put a little moat around it. And I'll be 100% honest. This is what's crazy is like, because there's 7 hours of content here and I can't be involved in everything. I didn't even know they were putting a moat around it. I like, cause there's like a bunch of trucks and cars around the city.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, for simplicity, cause we wanted people to focus on the city, you know, just removing that, all the stuff around the city, is what I was under the impression we were doing. And the thing is we locked the episode, but the like intense computer stuff happens after you lock it. So they made all these decisions after it was locked. And I was already moving on to future episodes. And then I received the final couple of episode one. And I saw that moat there and I was like, why the fuck is there a moat here? but it's too late now because the team's working on the future one. So I actually agree. I was like, I don't know why we put a moat there. I was under the understanding we were just going to, you know,
make it grass.
Make it grass. Yeah. I was like, this doesn't, especially because like when we're on top of the tower and stuff, you can see out back behind and you can see there's not a moat. So it's also just like not even immersive. It was a very... It's also only that one shot.
It's just one shot.
One shot. And 7 hours of content. There's one single shot. And they put a moat. Someone, somewhere of the 100 editors we're working with made a decision to put a moat there. And not running it by me. And I don't agree with it. But it is what it is. I can't change it now.
I want to ask you about my home country, India. Because you went to India.
I did.
And, you know, I've witnessed over the past probably 10 years, the creator economy just start to slowly grow. And it feels like it's exponentially
growing in India
over there in India. Yeah. Yeah. Like the first time I went out there, I got asked to speak at a college. Like this is years ago. Cause I was just like an Indian guy on YouTube that everyone was like, oh my God, there's an Indian guy on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I went and I spoke and at that time TikTok existed in India and there was people making, you know, a couple thousand bucks a month, which was super significant in India and rupees. Like that's really significant.
Yeah.
But now I'm looking at it. I'm like, these are some of the biggest channels.
Creators.
Yeah. Biggest
in terms
creators,
of views.
In terms of just straight up views. What do you think about, what was your experience like in India? And what do you think about the importance of India to the digital entertainment world?
Yeah. You know, India is my second largest audience behind USA now. Wow. It's very big for us. So, India was, it was not what I was expecting. There, people like, how do I say this where it doesn't sound arrogant? I mean, they just like, they really liked our channel over there. Like they were, I didn't tell anyone I was going there or anything, but there were like tons of people waiting at the airport for me to land and say hi to me there.
It's Indian hospitality.
Yeah. Hospitality. I'm kidding. No,
it's a crazy celebrity culture. It is a difference.
That is it. Yeah. It's like, I met so many people that had just seen every video I've ever made, knew every Mr. Beast lore. They were just so into it. And, the thing that actually was the craziest, because I went over there to film, we launched Feastables and Prime in India, but while I was there, I filmed with Karen Minotti.
Yeah.
And he brought like all the biggest creators from India over, like MythPat and a couple others. And I was just like, Kara would be like, oh, here's this guy. And I'd look at their channel. I'd be like, this guy's pulling 20 million views a video. Yeah. I've never even heard of him before.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's so many large creators over there. And like, you know, what's interesting, I don't think Kara would mind me saying this, is like, you know, Kara's audience is like almost 90% in India. It's like, wow. It was like 86%. And the other 14%, I believe, was like, whatever, like Pakistan or whatever, that other country that speaks Hindi. And so it's like, and I'm looking at all these other creators' analytics, and it's like almost all India. And so that's why we don't know who they are, right? And we don't know they exist. And most of your viewers don't know they exist because if you're not in India, you literally just don't get served their content. And it's because a lot of them do this thing where they speak English and Hindi and they bounce back and forth.
Yeah.
So then boom, it just dies there. Or they have, you know,
cultural
context, yes. But then they also have a lot of accents that are pretty thick and hard to understand if you're in America or Europe. And so, but yeah, it's like, for people who don't know, there is a massive creator scene in India. Like these, there are a lot of creators over there that are pulling tens of millions of views of video that are massive, like borderline, like demigods to like people in India. And, but the thing is their audience, their viewership is like basically all India. So you'll probably never hear of them unless you go there or like try to study it.
How does monetization get solved there, you think? Like, cause those are huge views, but monetization is really hard in India because there's not as big of an ad culture. Not as much disposable income from consumers.
Yeah.
So what happens? Do they like join?
But isn't there like a wave of like GDP growth that's coming in a major way? Yeah, and that's why all the like CPG brands are so interested in India.
Well, and also even if, let's say you make 1/7 per a view, but you know, because you know, these guys are pulling disgusting views because you get way more viewers, you know, maybe that helps close the gap. So I think the hope for them in the long run is as more and more people over there come online and start using these platforms, they'll just get more and more viewership, which will increase income. Yeah. Plus, like he said, GDP is rising over there. I think it's one of the fastest growing economies in the world. And so, you know, increased GDP plus more people coming online. I think the next couple of years, like it just is what it is. They're not going to make that much money. But I do think like you got to take a long, like I've been doing YouTube for 15 years. You know what I mean? You take the long-term approach, and I would say long-term, they're like a decade from now. Like I wouldn't be surprised if some of the top earners were in India, you know what I mean? On YouTube. But yeah, in the next 3 years, I just don't see it happening.
I think there could be scripted shows that emerge on YouTube that eventually turn into like Bollywood productions on YouTube.
Yeah. But even like Bollywood, like the highest grossing films just pale in comparison to Hollywood's highest grossing films. So it's just like, you know, it's just not a level playing field for them. But I do think the playing field, I mean, it won't be level in 10 years, but I think it will get more, you know, equilibralized over time. Yeah. And so I think the answer is just keep building, get the resources you can, go all in and realize that like the reward you'll get for the value you create will be higher in the future and you just got to win.
I'm surprised that there hasn't been as much exports of Indian entertainment to the US in the same way that South Korean entertainment has come to the US.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like Parasite and Squid Game. Like I'm just surprised that, and maybe that's something that ends up happening, is that some Indian creativity ends up in the US.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears and ask you questions about Hot Ones.
Okay.
So we made an episode about Hot Ones and it actually just sold. So BuzzFeed sold Hot Ones back to Sean Evans and some investors.
George Soros.
Oh, I thought it was Reddit and Link.
Mythical, yeah.
Well, yeah, they're a part of that too. Mythical's a part of it.
The article headline I saw said Mythical bought Hot Ones.
No, it's a group of people.
It's George Soros, Mythical, and Crooked Media.
Yeah.
And Sean Evans and Chris Schomburger bought Hot Ones.
So it sold for $82 million. But when we made our episode, it hadn't sold yet. And David, our showrunner, was on the show with us. And he was like, I have a hot take. I think that Mr. Beast would potentially buy Hot Ones from BuzzFeed.
If he never reached out. I mean, if he did, I probably...
Is that something you'd be interested in?
Of course.
You would acquire media properties like that?
I mean, I don't have that kind of money right now because I'm dumping everything into everything I'm doing. But I mean, we could have, you know, financed it through a bank. And I would have actually really loved to, you know, help run the show. And you know, just because especially with how knee deep I am in CPG, I mean, I could have showed them probably how to 2-3 exit sales and the sauce pretty quickly. So
maybe there's still an opportunity there.
It sounds like it already sold. When I saw that article, I was like, oh, he should have called me.
Second question, why haven't you been on Hot Ones yet?
I need to. Question. I mean, it's because I'm too busy doing 10,000 interviews with you guys. Okay. Hey, make a note. Next time we're going on Colin Samir, can it? We're going on Hot Ones.
It seems like you should.
I'm cool with that.
I want to.
Totally cool with that.
I mean, I hate with a passion hot food. Like I spicy food or whatever. I hate it. I hate it. So
that's perfect.
That's great.
Yeah.
You're the perfect candidate for it.
But I still want to do it. I wish I could just go talk to Sean without eating spicy shit. But
that's not the case.
I think I'll do it just because like some of my most viewed videos are when I bury myself alive, solitary confinement. People love watching me suffer. And so I think the same thing will happen here is like, because I hate it so much, it will really shine through and then that will make people enjoy it. So
I agree. I think that would be an astronomically viewed episode of Hot Ones.
But dude, you got a long day ahead of you.
I thought this was one of our better podcasts. Yeah,
it's fun. Yeah. Thanks for coming on.
Hopefully we're only getting better with time, man.
Yeah. Well, I remember, are we still doing this? I remember we used to do one a year and it always outperformed the best one. But I feel like we haven't topped that one from a couple years ago. I think your BTS video, which they haven't uploaded yet.
Yeah.
I think, depending on their title and thumbnail, I haven't seen it yet, but assuming they don't butcher it, I think that's going to be one of their most viewed videos. I think that BTS video is crazy. Like, there's no way that doesn't have like 25, 30 minute retention.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Yeah. It's going to be really fun. Well, dude, I'm excited for you. I'm excited to see how people react to the show.
Thank you.